At this point, the CIA entered the lists on the side of the KMT, drastically altering the balance of power. The Truman administration, ambivalent toward the conflict in Southeast Asia since it took office in 1945, was shocked into action by the sudden collapse of Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang regime. All the government agencies scrambled to devise policies, quote, to block further communist expansion in Asia, unquote. And in April 1950, the Joint Chiefs of Staff advised the Secretary of Defense that, quote, resolution of the situation facing Southeast Asia would be facilitated if prompt and continuing measures were undertaken to reduce the pressure from communist China. In this connection, the Joint Chiefs of Staff have noted the evidence of renewed vitality and apparent increased effectiveness of the Chinese nationalist forces. They went on to suggest the implementation of, quote, a program of special covert operations designed to interfere with communist activities in Southeast Asia, unquote. The exact details of the special covert operations planned for Burma were not spelled out in the Joint Chiefs of Staff memo or any of the other Pentagon papers because it was one of the most heavily classified operations ever undertaken by the CIA. The U.S. ambassador to Burma was not told. Top-ranking officials in the State Department were kept in the dark, and it was even hidden from the CIA's own deputy director for intelligence. From what can be gleaned from available documents and the events themselves, it seems that the Truman administration feared that Mao was bent on the conquest of Southeast Asia and would continually probe at China's southern frontier for an opening for his, quote, invading hordes. Although the Truman administration was confident that Indochina could be held against a frontal assault, there was concern that Burma might be the hole in the anti-communist dike. Couldn't Mao make an end run through Burma, sweep across Thailand, and attack Indochina from the rear? The apparent solution was to arm the KMT remnants in Burma and use them to make the Burma-China borderlands, from Tibet to Thailand, an impenetrable barrier. The first signs of direct CIA aid to the KMT appeared in early 1951 when Burmese intelligence officers reported that unmarked C-46 and C-47 transport aircraft were making at least 5 parachute drops a week to KMT forces in Mong Sat. With its new supplies, the KMT underwent a period of vigorous expansion and reorganization. Training bases staffed with instructors flown in from Taiwan were constructed near Mong Sat. KMT agents scoured the Kokang and Wa states along the Burma-China border for scattered KMT survivors, and General Li Mi's force burgeoned to 4,000 men. In April 1950, Li Mi led the bulk of his force up the Salween River to Mong Mao in the Wa states, where they established a base camp near the China border. As more stragglers were rounded up, a new base camp was opened at Mong Yang. Soon unmarked C-47s were seen making airdrops in the area. When Li Mi recruited 300 troops from Kokang State under the command of the Sabwa's younger sister, Olive Yang, more arms were again dropped to the KMT camp.
So we have the CIA arming the Kuomintang refugees in Burma, ostensibly to go after the Chinese communists and to present a barrier against a possible communist Chinese invasion of Southeast Asia. Well, as we've seen, as we know from history, that invasion never took place. It's worth noting that the CIA's aid to the Kuomintang forces in Burma was instrumental in permitting the Kuomintang forces, and we've looked at official Kuomintang involvement with the opium trade in the past, or earlier in the broadcast, I should say. This CIA aid to the Kuomintang forces in Burma permitted them to take over and expand the opium trade, the opium growing in the Shan states, a disputed area of Burma, continuing with the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. With the Burmese army still preoccupied with insurgency in other parts of Burma, the Kuomintang soon became the only effective government in all the Shan states' territories between the Salween River and the China border, Kokang, Hua, and Kengtung states. These territories were also Burma's major opium-producing region, and the shift in Kuomintang tactics allowed them to increase their control of the region's opium traffic. The Burmese government reported, quote, the Kuomintangs took over the control and administration of circles and village tracts. Circles, by the way, means districts. They started opening up revenue collection centers, and local people were being subjected to pay gate fees and ferry fees in entering their occupied area. Customs duties were also leveled on all commodities brought into their territories for trade. The taxes were collected in kind as well as money. By means of threat and coercion, these Kuomintang aggressors forced the local inhabitants to comply with their demands. The Kuomintang occupation centralized the marketing structure using hundreds of petty opium traders who combed the Shan Highlands. The Kuomintang also required that every hill tribe farmer pay an annual opium tax. One American missionary to the Lehu tribesmen of Kangtung State, Reverend Paul Lewis, recalls that the Kuomintang tax produced a dramatic rise in the amount of opium grown in the highland villages he visited. Tramps had very little choice in the matter, and he can still remember only too vividly the agony of the Lehu who were tortured by the Kuomintang for failing to comply with the regulations. Moreover, many Chinese soldiers married Lehu tribeswomen. These marriages reinforced Kuomintang control over the highlands and made it easier for them to secure opium and recruits. Through their personal contact in mountain villages, their powerful army, and their control over the opium-growing regions, the Kuomintang were in an ideal position to force an expansion of the Shan state's opium production when Yunnan's illicit production began to disappear in the early 1950s. Almost all the Kuomintang opium was sent south to Thailand, either by mule train or aircraft. Soon after their arrival in Burma, the Kuomintang formed a mountain transport unit, recruiting local mule drivers and their animals. Since most of their munitions and supplies were hauled overland from Thailand, the Kuomintang mule caravans found it convenient to haul opium on the outgoing trip from Mong Sot and soon developed a regular caravan trade with Thailand. Burmese military sources claim that much of the Kuomintang opium was flown from Mong Sot in unmarked C-47s flying to Thailand and Taiwan. Of course, the implication here is that those unmarked C-47s were CIA planes. We're going to look at later in the broadcast the role of Air America, a CIA air proprietary, in flying opium from Laos into Vietnam. Continuing here with McCoy's account. In any case, once the Kuomintang opium left Mong Sot, it was usually shipped to Chiang Mai, where a Kuomintang colonel maintained a liaison office with the Nationalist Chinese consulate and with local Thai authorities. Posing as ordinary Chinese merchants, the colonel and his staff used raw opium to pay for the munitions, food, and clothing that arrived from Bangkok at the Chiang Mai railhead. Once the materiel was paid for, it was this colonel's responsibility to forward it to Mong Sot. Usually, the Kuomintang dealt with the commander of the Thai police, General Phao, who shipped the opium from Chiang Mai to Bangkok for both local consumption and export. While the three CIA-sponsored invasions of Yunnan at least represented a feebly conceived anti-communist policy, the next move defied all logic. With what appeared to be CIA support, the Kuomintang began a full-scale invasion of eastern Burma. In late 1952, thousands of Kuomintang mercenaries forded the Salween River and began a well-orchestrated advance. The Burmese government claimed that this was the beginning of an attempt to conquer the entire country. But in March of 1953, the Burmese fielded three crack brigades and quickly drove them back across the Salween. Interestingly, after a skirmish with the Kuomintang at the Wan Sa La Ferry, Burmese soldiers discovered the bodies of three white men who bore no identification other than some personal letters with Washington and New York addresses. So here we not only have the CIA aiding the Kuomintang and providing them with the necessary muscle to control and expand the Burmese opium trade, thereby carrying it through their caravans into Thailand as well, where a lot of it was marketed. But apparently, in 1952, the CIA actually began aiding the Kuomintang in an operation against Burma, according to the Burmese, with the aid of taking over the entire country.
And as we will see, there was no lack of knowledge of this. As a matter of fact, as we'll see in the end of the next segment, and as by 1952, articles were being printed in the New York Times detailing the fact that these activities were going on. So there's no excuse of ignorance on the part of American officials. Anyway, continuing with a slightly later section in the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. Although forgotten by the international press, the Kuomintang guerrilla operations continued to create problems for both the Burmese and Chinese governments. When delegations from the Union of Burma and the People's Republic of China met to resolve a border dispute in the summer of 1960, they also concluded a secret agreement for combined operations against the KMT base at Mong Pa Liao. This base, with a runway capable of handling the largest transport aircraft, was defended by some 10,000 Kuomintang troops entrenched in an elaborate fortifications complex. After weeks of heavy fighting, 5,000 Burmese troops and three full People's Liberation Army divisions totaling 20,000 men finally overwhelmed the fortress on January 26, 1961. While many of their hill tribe recruits fled into the mountains, the crack KMT units retreated across the Mekong River into northwestern Laos. Burmese officers were outraged to discover American arms of recent manufacture and 5 tons of ammunition bearing distinctive red, white, and blue labels. In Rangoon, 10,000 angry demonstrators marched in front of the U.S. Embassy, and Burma sent a note of protest to the United States saying that, quote, large quantities of modern military equipment, mainly of American origin, have been captured by Burmese forces, unquote. State Department officials in Washington disclaimed any responsibility for the arms and promised appropriate action against Taiwan if investigation showed that its military aid shipments had been diverted to Burma. Another round of airlifts to Taiwan began. On April 5th, Taiwan announced the end of the flights, declaring that 4,200 soldiers had been repatriated. 6 days later, Taiwan joined the State Department in disavowing any responsibility for the 6,000 remaining troops. However, within months, the CIA began hiring these disowned Kuomintang remnants as mercenaries for its secret operations in northwestern Laos. Let me read that again to you. Within months, the CIA began hiring these disowned Kuomintang remnants as mercenaries for its secret operations in northwestern Laos. At first glance, the history of the Kuomintang's involvement in the Burmese opium trade seems to be just another case of a CIA client taking advantage of the agency's political protection to enrich itself from the narcotics trade. But upon closer examination, the CIA appears to be much more seriously compromised in this affair. The CIA fostered the growth of the Yunnan Province Anti-Communist National Salvation Army in the borderlands of northeastern Burma, a potentially rich opium-growing region. There is no question of CIA ignorance or naivete, for as early as 1952, the New York Times and other major American newspapers published detailed accounts of the KMT role in the narcotics trade. But most disturbing of all is the coincidence that the Kuomintang's Bangkok connection, the commander of the Thai police, General Phao, P-H-A-O, was the CIA's man in Thailand.
Still more about General Phao appears in McCoy's book. Continuing, there can be little doubt that the CIA support was an invaluable asset to General Phao in managing the opium traffic. The agency supplied the aircraft, motor vehicles, and naval vessels that gave Phao the logistic capability to move opium from the poppy fields to the sea lanes. And his role in protecting sea supplies shipments to the Kuomintang no doubt gave Phao a considerable advantage in establishing himself as the exclusive exporter of Kuomintang opium. By the way, sea supply was a CIA proprietary set up by a CIA agent named Paul Helliwell that was operating in conjunction with Kuomintang.
You may want to start this over again because I want to mention, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
Right. Now, recapping what we just looked at, we looked at how basically the military muscle provided to the Kuomintang exiles in Burma by CIA enabled them to take over the Burmese opium trade and expand it. This opium trade was used to provide them with the necessary income to support their mercenary army in Burma. This mercenary army not only operated against communist China, which it was supposed to, it also began operating against Burma in an attempt to take over Burma entirely, and apparently did so with CIA support. And eventually, of course, this CIA-strengthened Kuomintang group in Burma began shipping opium on a regular basis to Thailand, and their primary contact there was the CIA's man in Thailand, General Phao. Now, resuming once again this section of the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia, there can be little doubt that the CIA support was an invaluable asset to General Phao in managing the opium traffic. The agency supplied the aircraft, motor vehicles, and naval vessels that gave Phao the logistic capability to move opium from the poppy fields to the sea lanes. And his role in protecting sea supplies shipments to the Kuomintang no doubt gave Phao a considerable advantage in establishing himself as the exclusive exporter of Kuomintang opium. And recall again, sea supply, a CIA proprietary. Resuming the narrative. Given its even greater involvement in the Kuomintang's Shan State's opium commerce, how do we evaluate the CIA's role in the evolution of large-scale opium trafficking in the Burma-Thailand region? Under the Kennedy administration, presidential advisor Walt W. Rostow popularized a doctrine of economic development that preached that a stagnant, underdeveloped economy could be jarred into a period of rapid growth, an economic takeoff, unquote, by a massive injection of foreign aid and capital, which could then be withdrawn as the economy coasted into a period of self-sustained growth. CIA support for Phao and the Kuomintang seems to have sparked such a takeoff, unquote, in the Burma-Thailand opium trade during the 1950s. Modern aircraft replaced mules, naval vessels replaced sampans, and well-trained military organizations expropriated the traffic from bands of illiterate mountain traders. Never before had the Shan states encountered smugglers with the discipline, technology, and ruthlessness of the Kuomintang. Under General Fao's leadership, Thailand had changed from an opium-consuming nation to the world's most important opium distribution center. The Golden Triangle's opium production approached its present scale. Burma's total harvest had increased from less than 40 tons just before World War II to 300 to 400 tons in 1962, with Thailand's expanded at an even greater rate from 7 tons to over 100 tons. In a 1970 report, the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics concluded, quote, "By the end of the 1950s, Burma, Laos, and Thailand together had become a massive producer and the source of more than half the world's present illicit supply of 1,250 to 14,000 tons annually. Moreover, with this increase in output, the region of the Far East and Southeast Asia quickly became self-sufficient in opium. But was this increase in opium production the result of a conscious decision by the CIA to support its allies FAO and the Kuomintang through the narcotics traffic? Was this the CIA's Operation X?" Interrupting, we'll look at Operation X presently. "There can be no doubt that the CIA knew its allies were heavily involved in the traffic. Headlines made it known to the whole world, and FAO was responsible for Thailand's censure by the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs. Certainly, the CIA did nothing to halt the trade or to prevent its aid from being abused. But whether the CIA actively organized the traffic is something only the agency itself can answer. In any case, by the early 1960s, the Golden Triangle had become the largest single opium-growing region in the world, a vast reservoir able to supply America's lucrative markets should any difficulties arise in the Mediterranean heroin complex. The Golden Triangle had surplus opium, it had well-protected, disciplined syndicates. With the right set of circumstances, it could easily become America's major heroin supplier. And those circumstances were soon to develop." So again, we've taken a look at the role of the CIA in promoting the Kuomintang's exile armies in the Golden Triangle in Burma, Laos, and Thailand, in promoting raising the Golden Triangle into one of the major opium production centers in the entire world. As McCoy indicates in that section, it's unclear whether this was a result of conscious CIA policy, although in light of events that we're going to be covering in future broadcasts, that's a possibility that can't be ruled out. The point is that so far, we've taken a look at CIA anti-communist counterinsurgency programs and cooperative programs with organized crime syndicates in Sicily, Corsica, and in China, and we've looked at how these resulted in the dominant post-war opium production centers and heroin importing networks. We've looked at how the Sicilian Mafia was restored to power, and in turn, Sicilian Mafia cooperates with Corsican Syndica, which gets its necessary muscle also from CIA. That becomes the French connection. We then took a look at how the Kuomintang began working with with U.S. intelligence. Kuomintang in turn relying heavily on a dope syndicate run by Tu Yuesheng and Tai Li. This Kuomintang-U.S. intelligence relationship continues with the Kuomintang exile army in Burma receiving heavy CIA support, using that increased muscle to not only control the Shan state's opium traffic, but to expand it greatly and to turn that region into one of the dominant opium-producing regions in the world. And as we've seen, the Kuomintang forces in Burma work very closely, and therefore their traffic is moved by General Fao of Thailand, the CIA's man in Thailand.
Now, we talked earlier in the broadcast about how heroin and illicit narcotics in general become a political tool in the way that they can supply money for clandestine operations. We're going to look now at how heroin became one of the major factors in Vietnam, even predating the American presence in Vietnam, and how the idea of heroin as a major gain of political and actual economic capital came to be. Reading again from Alfred McCoy's book, The Politics of Heroin, etc., etc. They're talking again about Vietnam. "The French suffered through several years of frustrating stalemate before realizing that their application of classical textbook precepts was losing the war. By the way, just mentioning, this is the war taking place after World War II in Vietnam, where the French, the Vietnamese, who again had fought as resistance troops to the Japanese, fully expected to be granted their independence. And instead, due to some deals cut between within the groups of the Allies, most notably between the French and English and the United States, the French were handed back their colonial possession of Vietnam. But as the French were to find out, things had changed and would never be the same again. So the French suffered through this several years of frustrating stalemate before realizing their application of textbook precepts was losing the war. But they slowly developed a new strategy of counter-guerrilla or counter-insurgency warfare. By 1950 to 1951, younger, innovative French officers had abandoned the conventional war precepts that essentially visualized Indochina as a depopulated staging ground for fortified lines, massive sweeps, and flanking maneuvers. Instead, Indochina became a vast chessboard where hill tribes, bandits, and religious minorities could be used as pawns to hold certain territories and prevent Viet Minh infiltration. The Viet Minh were the precursors to what we knew as the Viet Cong. The French concluded formal alliances with a number of these ethnic or religious factions and supplied them with arms and money to keep the Viet Minh out of their area. The French hope was to atomize the Viet Minh's mobilized, unified mass into a mosaic of autonomous fiefs hostile to the revolutionary movement. Major Roger Trinquier and Captain Antoine Savani were the most important apostles of this new military doctrine. Captain Savani secured portions of Cochin China, comprising Saigon and the Mekong Delta, by rallying river pirates, Catholics, and messianic religious cults to the French side. Along the spine of the Annamite Mountains from the central highlands to the China border, Major Trinquier recruited an incredible variety of hill tribes. By 1954, more than 40,000 tribal mercenaries were busy ambushing Viet Minh supply lines, safeguarding territory, and providing intelligence. Other French officers organized Catholic militia from parishes in the Tonkin Delta, Nung pirates on the Tonkin Gulf, and a Catholic militia in Hue. Although the French euphemistically referred to these local troops as, quote, supplementary forces, and attempted to legitimize their leaders with ranks, commissions, and military decorations, they were little more than mercenaries, and very greedy, very expensive mercenaries at that. To ensure the loyalty of the Binh Xian River pirates, who guarded Saigon, the French allowed them to organize a variety of lucrative criminal enterprises and paid them an annual stipend of $85,000 as well. Trinquier may have had 40,000 hill tribe guerrillas under his command by 1954, but he also had to pay dearly for their services. He needed an initial outlay of $15,000 for basic training, arms, and bonuses to set up each mercenary unit of 150 men. It is no exaggeration to say that the success of Savani's and Tanquier's work depended almost entirely on adequate financing. If they were well-funded, they could expand their programs almost indefinitely. But without capital, they could not even begin. But the counterinsurgency efforts were continually plagued by a lack of money. The war was tremendously unpopular in France, and the French National Assembly reduced its outlay to barely enough for the regular military units, leaving almost nothing for extras such as paramilitary or intelligence work. Moreover, the High Command itself never really approved of the younger generation's unconventional approach, and were unwilling to divert scarce funds from the regular units. Trinquier still complains that the High Command never understood what he was trying to do, and says that they consistently refused to provide sufficient funds for his operations. The solution was Operation X, a clandestine narcotics traffic so secret that only high-ranking French and Vietnamese officials even knew of its existence. The anti-opium drive that began in 1946 received scant support from the, quote, Indochina hands. Customs officials, by Indochina hands they mean the people who'd been there for a long time, the old French officials. Customs officials continued to purchase raw opium from the Mayo, that's a tribe, and the opium smoking dens, cosmetically renamed detoxification clinics, continued to sell unlimited quantities of opium. However, on September 3, 1948, the French High Commissioner announced that each smoker had to register with the government, submit to a medical examination to ascertain the degree of his addiction, and then be weaned of the habit by having his dosage gradually reduced. Statistically, the program was a success. The Customs Service had bought 60 tons of raw opium from the Mayo and Yao in 1943, but in 1951 they purchased almost nothing. The detoxification clinics, quote-unquote, were closed, and the hermetically sealed opium packets each addict purchased from the Customs Service contained a constantly dwindling amount of opium. But the opium trade remained essentially unchanged. The only real differences were that the government, having abandoned opium as a source of revenue, now faced serious budgetary problems. And the French intelligence community, having secretly taken over the opium trade, had all theirs solved. The opium monopoly had gone underground to become Operation X.
We're going to look at more of how Operation X is financed, how Operation X was supervised right now. And the implication for this is, of course, that these very same tribesmen, when the U.S. took over the French role in Vietnam, these very same tribesmen then became instrumental in the so-called secret war in Laos. The Hmong or Mayo tribesmen became a key element of the CIA operation as well. We're going to look at that in just a second. Continuing now with some more discussion of Operation X. During its peak years from 1951 to 1954, Operation X was sanctioned down the highest levels by Colonel Belleau, B-E-L-L-E-U-X, for SDECE and General Raoul Salon for the Expeditionary Corps. Below them, Major Tronquier of MACG assured Operation X a steady supply of Mayo opium by ordering his liaison officers serving with Mayo Commander Tubi Lai Fung and Thai Federation leader Deo Van Long to buy opium at a competitive price. Among the various French paramilitary agencies, the work of the Mixed Airborne Command Group, MACG, was most inextricably interwoven with the opium trade, and not only in order to finance operations. For its field officers in Laos and Tonkin had soon realized that unless they provided a regular outlet for the local opium production, the prosperity and loyalty of their hill tribe allies would be undermined. Once the opium was collected after the annual spring harvest, Tranquier had the mountain guerrillas fly it to Captain Saint-Jacques Vang Tu near Saigon. With the Action Service School trained hill tribe mercenaries at a military base, there were no customs or police controls to interfere with or expose the illicit shipments here. From Cap Saint-Jacques, the opium was trucked the 60 miles into Saigon and turned over to the Binh Duyen bandits, who were there serving as the city's local militia and managing its opium traffic under the supervision of Captain Antoine Savani of the Duyen Bureau. The Binh Duyen, by the way, it's B-I-N-H-X-U-Y-E-N, the Binh Duyen operated two major opium boiling plants in Saigon, one near their headquarters at Cho Lon's Y Bridge and the other near the National Assembly, to transform the raw poppy sap into a smokable form. The bandits distributed the prepared opium to dens and retail shops throughout Saigon and Cho Lon, some of which were owned by the Binh Duyen. The others paid the gangsters a substantial share of their profits for protection. The Binh Duyen divided its receipts with Tranquier's MACG and Savani's Duyen Bureau. Any surplus opium the Binh Duyen were unable to market was sold to local Chinese merchants for export to Hong Kong or else to the Corsican criminal syndicates in Saigon for shipment to Marseille. MACG deposited its portion in a secret account managed by the Action Service Office in Saigon. When Tubi Lai Fung, that's T-O-U-B-Y-L-Y-F-O-U-N-G, or any other Mayo tribal leader needed money, he flew to Saigon and personally drew money out of the caisse noire, or black box. So, basically, the MACG, the Military Airborne Command Group, which was the sort of patchwork quilt of local tribesmen put together by Major Tronquier and which served as a mercenary army for the French in Vietnam, was dependent in much the same way as the Kuomintang's CIA-supported forces in Burma were dependent on the opium traffic in order to finance their military operations. And again, this Operation X here represented a taking over, in essence, of the opium trade in Southeast Asia or in Vietnam by French intelligence in order to finance its mercenary army, chiefly the Mayo tribesmen. The Mayo, or Hmong tribesmen as they're known, I think they prefer to be known as the Hmong tribesmen. The Mayo or Hmong tribesmen are opium farmers, and it was this opium crop which financed their military operations. And this is a pattern which was then to reassert itself after the U.S. assumed the French role in Indochina.
Talking a little bit about the changeover, and again, the United States first came into Vietnam to help to try and bail the French out of the siege at Dien Bien Phu, and found themselves growing increasingly enmeshed in the political climate of Vietnam and to the doctrine of facing off against the communism, which was conceived of as being a monolithic bloc, wherever it might appear. And as the French began to pull out, the Americans began to ease into their place. Reading some more from The Politics of Heroin. When the French Expeditionary Corps began its rapid withdrawal from Indochina in 1955, MACG officers, remember that is essentially the local mercenary troops put together by the French, MACG officers approached American military personnel and offered to turn over their entire paramilitary apparatus. CIA agent Lucien Conain was one of those contacted, and he passed the word along to Washington. But, quote, DOD, Department of Defense, responded that they wanted nothing to do with any French program, unquote, and the offer was refused. But many in the agency regretted the decision when the CIA sent Green Berets into Laos and Vietnam to organize Hill Tribe guerrillas several years later. And in 1962, American representatives visited Trottier in Paris and offered him a high position as an advisor on mountain warfare in Indochina. But fearing that the Americans would never give a French officer sufficient authority to accomplish anything, Trottier refused. So right away, although as they mention here, that there was some dislocation between the MACG groups and certain people in the Department of Defense not wanting to make those kinds of connections. As we will see, the rest of the changeover was remarkably smooth in terms of the old networks being picked up. And part of the old networks, as we know, was Operation X, which was the plan to use the heroin trade that had been taken over by French military intelligence to turn the heroin trade into something that would benefit the anti-communist war effort. And as we shall see, in fact, the U.S. government took this same heroin trade over themselves, entrusting it to their own hand-picked mercenaries, and used it for basically the same types of purposes.
It should be noted here, just perhaps in passing, that the old French colony of Indochina comprised what is today Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. That was all part of the same colony, so they were not separate countries in those days. However, of course, after the defeat of the French at Dien Bien Phu, they did become separate nations. Now, again, in Laos, the CIA then picked up more or less where the French in Operation X left off. They began subsidizing the Hmong or Mayo tribesmen as a secret army in Laos to harass North Vietnamese supplies moving into what was then known as South Vietnam. Of the American assumption of the French Operation X, in essence, or of the French mercenary opium army in Laos, McCoy writes as follows. In Laos, CIA clandestine intervention produced changes and upheavals in the narcotics traffic. When political infighting among the Lao elite and escalating war forced the small Corsican charter airlines out of the opium business in 1965, the CIA's airline Air America began flying Mayo opium out of the hills to Long Cheng, and Vientiane. CIA cross-border intelligence missions into China from Laos reaped an unexpected dividend in 1962 when the Shan rebel leader who organized the forays for the agency began financing the Shan nationalist cause by selling Burmese opium to another CIA protege, Laotian General Phoumi Nosavan, Phoumi Nosavan. The economic alliance between General Phoumi and the Shans opened up a new trading pattern that diverted increasingly significant quantities of Burmese opium from their normal marketplace in Bangkok. In the late 1960s, U.S. Air Force bombing disrupted Laotian opium production by forcing the majority of the Mayo opium farmers to become refugees. However, flourishing Laotian heroin laboratories, which are the major suppliers for the GI market in Vietnam, simply increased their imports of Burmese opium through already established trading relationships. The importance of these CIA clients in the subsequent growth of the Golden Triangle's heroin trade was revealed inadvertently by the agency itself when it leaked a classified report on the Southeast Asian opium traffic to the New York Times. The CIA analysis identified 21 opium refineries in the tri-border area where Burma, Thailand, and Laos converge, and reported that 7 were capable of producing 90% to 99% pure number 4 heroin. Of these 7 heroin refineries, quote, the most important are located in the areas around Tachilek, Burma, Ban Hoai Sai and Nem Kyong in Laos, and Mae Salong in Thailand. Although the CIA did not bother to mention it, many of these refineries are located in areas totally controlled by paramilitary groups closely identified with American military operations in the Golden Triangle area. Mae Salong is headquarters for the Nationalist Chinese Fifth Army, which has been continuously involved in CIA counterinsurgency and intelligence operations since 1950. According to a former CIA operative who worked in the area for a number of years, the heroin laboratory at Nam Kyung is protected by Major Chao La, C-H-A-O-L-A, commander of Yao mercenary troops for the CIA in northwestern Laos. One of the heroin laboratories near Ban Wai Se reportedly belongs to General Wane Ratikone, R-A-T-T-I-K-O-N-E, former commander-in-chief of the Royal Laotian Army, the only army in the world, except for the U.S. Army, entirely financed by the U.S. government. The heroin factories near Tachilek are operated by Burmese paramilitary units and Shan rebel armies who control a relatively small percentage of Burma's narcotics traffic. Although few of these Shan groups have any relation to the CIA today, one of the most important chapters in the history of the Shan state's opium trade involves a Shan rebel army closely allied with the CIA. Other sources have revealed the existence of an important heroin laboratory operating in the Vientiane region under the protection of General Juan Ratikone. Finally, the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics has reported that General Vang Pao, commander of the CIA's secret army, has been operating a heroin refactory at Long Tieng, headquarters for CIA operations in northern Laos. So we see basically the same pattern that we saw under the French Operation X, holding firm when the CIA assumes stewardship of the Hmong or Mayo tribesmen. They are opium farmers. In order to keep fighting, their opium has to be sold. And one of the most disturbing things, and we're going to be developing this a little further, is how Air America, a CIA air proprietary, flew the opium from Laos into Vietnam. We're going to be going into just why it was being flown into Vietnam and what it was doing there after we take a short break. But it's worth noting here that Air America, a CIA air proprietary, very much, by the way, in the news right now, was flying this opium into Laos. And incidentally, Air America, and again, we're now talking October 16th, 1986, Air America is very much in the news recently because last week an apparently CIA airplane, including a gentleman named Eugene Hassenfuss, was shot down in Nicaragua. Hassenfuss, in addition to admitting he worked for U.S. intelligence, revealed that he flew for Air America in Vietnam in the 60s.
All right, continuing and getting a little more into Air America and their co-option, if there is such a word, of the air traffic of opium coming out of the Mayo tribesmen's regions, are also known as the Hmong, H-M-O-N-G, you've probably seen that. And reading more from McCoy's book, wartime conditions had increased Mayo dependence on poppy cultivation, and the lack of air transport created serious economic problems for hill tribe opium farmers, excuse me. Since the CIA was using the Mayo population to combat Pathet Lao forces in the mountains of northeastern Laos, the Pathet Lao are the communist Laotian army, the prosperity and well-being of this tribe was of paramount importance to the agency's success. By 1965, the CIA had created a Mayo army of 30,000 men that guarded radar installations vital to bombing North Vietnam, rescued downed American pilots, and battled Pathet Lao guerrillas. Without air transport for their opium, the Mayo faced economic ruin. There was simply no form of air transport available in northern Laos except the CIA's charter airline, Air America. And, according to several sources, Air America began flying opium from mountain villages north and east of the Plain of Jars to General Vang Pao's headquarters at Long Tien. Air America was known to be flying Mayo opium as late as 1971. Mayo village leaders in the area west of the Plain of Jars, for example, claimed that their 1970 and 71 opium harvests were bought up by Vang Pao's officers and flown to Long Tien on Air America UH-1H Huey helicopters. This opium was probably destined for heroin laboratories in Long Tien or Vientiane and ultimately for GI addicts in Vietnam. The U.S. Embassy in Vientiane adopted an attitude of benign neglect toward the opium traffic. When one American journalist wrote the embassy complaining that Laotian officials were involved in the drug trade, U.S. Ambassador G. McMurtry Godley responded in a letter dated December 2, 1970, quote, Regarding your information about opium traffic between Laos and the United States, the purchase of opium in Southeast Asia is certainly less difficult than in other parts of the world. But I believe that the Royal Laotian government takes its responsibility seriously to prohibit international opium traffic. However, latest information available to me indicated that all of Southeast Asia produces only 5% of narcotics, which are, unfortunately, illegally imported to Great Britain and the U.S. As you undoubtedly are already aware, our government is making every effort to contain this traffic, and I believe the Narcotics Bureau in Washington, D.C. can give you additional information if you have some other inquiries. But the latest information available to Ambassador Godley should have indicated that most of the heroin being used by American GIs in Vietnam was coming from Laotian laboratories. The exact location of Laos's flourishing laboratories was common knowledge among even the most junior U.S. bureaucrats. Okay, so here we see, basically, the CIA has now gone from a slightly more passive role, or at least more clandestine role in the heroin traffic, to direct intercession. The CIA has begun to fly opium out of the hills of Laos and hand it over to their puppet generals. Now, when the Ambassador Godley writes to this American journalist and says... how does he put it? Our government is making every effort to contain this traffic. He perhaps was either being cynical and sarcastic, or he was telling more truth than he knew. For as a matter of fact, the CIA was certainly doing its best to contain the traffic, and had contained the traffic pretty thoroughly, since they had a monopoly on the air transport of opium at that point. And bear in mind again, folks, while we're talking about this several years after the fact, these things are still going on. But in this case, most specifically, many of you out there either were in Vietnam, had relatives in Vietnam, sons, fathers, brothers, cousins. Some of them came back with heroin habits. As a matter of fact, this is one of the things that caused the jump in heroin usage in the United States, was returning American soldiers.
Specifically, the American addict population tripled as a result of Vietnam. Ultimately, the opium traffic in Vietnam was being contained in the veins of American GIs. We're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to give you some of the background as to just how our troops wound up being addicted by the very people they were fighting to support, and by the government who sent them there to fight in the first place.
We'll be right back. Don't go away. We'll return with more of Radio Free America in just a moment on KFJC. And we're back for the home stretch of tonight's Radio Free America. This is NipTuck with Dave Emery in the studios at KFJC, and we are just into the final 25 minutes or so of tonight's broadcast, the first of at least three, and possibly four, because as you can see, it's a massive story on the collusion of international intelligence and the international drug trade. And right now, we have just finished talking about a very important step when the CIA stopped being just a clandestine behind-the-scenes manipulator of the drug traffic and the political gains attached thereto, and became, for the first time, at least as far as we can tell, an active full-time participant using a CIA proprietary owned and operated airline, Air America, to bring the opium down out of the Laos Hills, the Mayo tribesmen's opium farms, and down, and giving them to the troops of General Vang Pao, who was essentially a CIA pawn, I guess would be a nice way to put it.
All right, tool, perhaps.
Tool is a good
whatever
word.
You know, a rose by any other name, or a poppy, for that matter.
That's right.
Now, perhaps the most tragic aspect of the CIA's active involvement in the narcotics traffic in Southeast Asia was the fact that many of the victims of that traffic were the very troops who had been sent there in order to support the government of South Vietnam. As indicated in the passage that Nip read you just before the break, many, many GIs, and as I'm sure a great many of you are aware, a great many GIs became addicted to heroin in Vietnam, and their return to the United States after their tour of duty tripled the addict population of the United States. As we've indicated, or as we've seen, that heroin was being grown by CIA allies in Laos, was coming out of Laos via the CIA, and was being transported into South Vietnam, and the main traffickers, as we're going to begin looking at in just a second, were key elements of the South Vietnamese government. Looking at the heroin epidemic among American GIs in Vietnam, returning once again to the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy. The sudden burst of heroin addiction among GIs in 1970 was the most important development in Southeast Asia's narcotics traffic since the region attained self-sufficiency in opium production in the late 1950s. By 1968-69, the Golden Triangle region was harvesting close to 1,000 tons of raw opium annually, exporting morphine-based to European heroin laboratories, and shipping substantial quantities of narcotics to Hong Kong, both for local consumption and re-export to the United States. Although large amounts of chunky, low-grade number 3 heroin were being produced in Bangkok and the Golden Triangle for the local market, there were no laboratories anywhere in Southeast Asia capable of producing the fine-grained, 80 to 99% pure number 4 heroin. However, in late 1969 and early 1970, Golden Triangle Laboratories added the final, dangerous ether precipitation process and converted to production of number 4 heroin.